And we move to impairments. They're waiting for some stats, probably. Come so quickly.
All right, that's the question Sue was just saying. Again, that we're gonna try and pick up from the base. Just off the word.
Between not describing what meetings we have ahead of us now with. I see it comes here, like it's, capital. Next week. Discussed, to some extent, how to organize the meeting. Where he and us pray that we were opening up, like, opinions, what I always wish. And the basic consideration, we should discuss, what we have to manage, but the risk of thing, but. So, more or less. Some, older funds.
Sorry? You mean, they weren't here? Yeah. Omar will learn. Good on Tiernan for getting here. You had a magic, insight into comic.
Yeah, it was. Paid any golf?
Yeah.
We got, three times 18 holes and, six times 9 holes in the results. Brit.
You should say that Kumar, this never happened.
This was the first time I got the swing right.
It's never happened when Sue.
Or 10 days.
Okay. Impairment. Rihanna?
Yes, thank you. So this, at this meeting, we are only planning to discuss one paper, and that is on disclosure. And this will then, once we've done this and you've agreed with us, this will be
then what?
And we've agreed with her.
You've agreed with us. This will conclude our substantive discussions or deliberations on the impairment project. Okay. And I will say something about that at the end of the meeting again. But I will hand over to Tiena now to...
This is an inducement to agree with you.
Yes. Yes. Seems to be organized in such a way that...
Not once, but twice.
She's teasing us a little bit, but...
Good manager not to shut up a room.
The sooner we can get to the input.
Are we sure we don't want to discuss a seventh model?
Just a little bit. Just a little. Just a little.
Okay.
Tiena.
All right. So the paper you have before you today is paper 5A, and it analyzes the feedback we've received on the proposed presentation and disclosure requirements and considers whether any changes to the requirements should be made. The staff in general have tried to enhance and expand the disclosure objectives and to objectify the individual disclosure requirements in a way that enables users of financial statements to predict the amounts, timing, and uncertainty of future cash flows. As a part of this effort, the staff has also considered the recommendations of the report of the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. As the vast majority of respondents agreed with the presentation requirements, we do not intend to discuss those again. For this board meeting, I'll discuss the main changes we are proposing to the disclosure requirements. I'll begin with the reconciliation requirement, after which we'll ask the board a question, move on to collateral, after again which we'll ask the board a question, and finally discuss the other requirements. So, to begin with reconciliation, the exposure draft proposed that an entity should provide a reconciliation of the gross carrying amount and the loss allowance for financial assets. This proposal received a large amount of feedback, with many respondents opposing the requirement to reconcile the gross carrying amount due to operational concerns. There was more support for the reconciliation of the loss allowance, and therefore we do not intend to discuss that requirement. The staff think that the reconciliation disclosure is key to understanding the model and how expected credit losses have developed. In this agenda paper, we therefore recommend to retain the proposed requirement. However, we do recognize the operational concerns and have developed two alternatives for the gross carrying amount to address these while still providing useful information. As you'll see in the agenda paper, alternative A is to require a full reconciliation as proposed in the ED for assets at lifetime expected credit losses, otherwise at assets at stage 2 and 3. However, a simplified reconciliation that shows the beginning and ending gross carrying amount along with the amount of originations and purchases during the period would be required for assets at 12-month expected credit losses. This alternative would align the proposals with the EDTF recommendation for impaired or non-performing loans and reduce the burden for a large population of assets while still allowing users to differentiate between changes in the loss allowance due to new assets versus the deterioration of existing assets. Alternative B would...
TNN, just before we go there,
yeah.
You said it would reconcile with the EDTF. To what extent?
The EDTF requires a full reconciliation of both the gross carrying amount and the loss allowance for assets that are impaired or non-performing, and this is based off IAS 39 guidance. So the only difference with alternative A is that we'd have the amount of originations and purchases during the period for assets that are performing or at stage one.
But why is that aligned? Because we're requiring that for all levels of which we have expected losses. And the EDTF is only requiring that, as you said, for non-performing and impaired, which would be, if we asking for that for our stage 3 financial assets. So it is not aligned.
That is true. The alignment is not perfect. But what we're attempting to do is to align it more closely while still retaining what we feel is a key piece of information for users, and that's the ability to understand how the loss allowance develops. So moving on to alternative B. Alternative B would require a reconciliation of the gross carrying amount for assets at both 12-month and lifetime expected credit losses that focuses on the key drivers for changes in the loss allowance. Compared to alternative A, this would only show purchases and originations for assets at 12-month expected credit losses. This alternative would expect entities to provide information, relevant information, about any item that would have a significant effect on the development of the loss allowance. So given that, I'll give it over to Rihanna to discuss a bit more.
Subsequent to the posting of this agenda paper, we've done a bit more outreach and we talked to some industry groups to better understand the concerns they had about presenting or providing the information for the roll forward of the gross asset balances. And during these discussions, the two main concerns that they really have with giving the information, and it also affects the meaningfulness of the information they are providing, is for the assets that you are assessing significant increases in credit risk on a collective basis, that assessment is done in a sort of a snapshot way. So at the end of the year, if you do a top-down approach, for example, you would look at the assets and say, let's say 10% of the portfolio need to have lifetime losses on, and you would calculate lifetime losses on that 10% of the assets. But at the end of the next reporting period, you would look at the portfolio again, and now you may decide there is, let's say, 12% of the assets that need lifetime losses. The difference between the previous period and this period is not necessarily 10 plus 2. It could be a whole new 12%. So you can't just show the movement as a net 2% flowing into stage 2. And the other concern is that by doing that, you're not necessarily putting the assets into stage 2 as such. They are still in stage 1 because you can't identify which assets you have to transfer. There's also a problem with the interaction between the risk management systems and the accounting systems, and the information between the two is not necessarily flowing through. So providing a roll forward of the gross carrying amount of the assets on an amortized cost basis may not necessarily agree or reconcile to what it is in the risk management systems. So you will have a disconnect between the information. We've also discussed these roll forwards with some users over the past week or so, and what they've indicated is that they would find alternative B more meaningful and the information provided through alternative B than they would for alternative A. Because on alternative B, it covers all the assets, so you've got all through the stages, and that will give them the information they need about the new assets being originated and the loss allowances attributed to those, and also what is the credit quality of the assets being brought into stage one. If you've got a high-risk lender, you won't see that information unless you've got the roll forward that you can tie back to the loss allowance. So taking all of that feedback that we've received into account, we think if you do consider or you want to consider these operational concerns, most of these concerns could be addressed through approach B, where we can retain the requirement for the loss allowance roll forward as it was in the exposure draft, instead of providing an illustrative example of the roll forward on the gross asset balance. We can give an example on the loss allowance, and we can get a we can put in the objective of what the roll forward on the assets side should achieve. That will enable the entities to provide the information that is relevant to understand the changes in the loss allowance without obscuring that with other changes in the assets which don't affect the loss allowance. And with that, I think we'll hand over to you for discussion.
A question about the originations. There are two types of loans, the short-term ones, which are originated and repaid in full during the period under review, and the ones which stay and carry over to the next periods. What's the benefit of a disclosure regarding those loans which have been originated and repaid in full without a credit loss during the period? Is there any benefit of having this information when assessing the riskiness of the portfolio and the amount of the expected credit losses in the portfolio? And of course, for those which have been originated and are carried over because they extend over the period, of course, there is a benefit in. So should not there be a distinction in the disclosure of about originated loans between those which stay on the balance sheet and those which disappear quickly? And I think there are a lot of bank loans, like credit cards, for instance, where the turnover of the loans is quick. So I'm trying to think about how to apply this concept to the credit cards and some of our revolving loans. Is it operational and is it useful?
The credit card example is something that some of the preparers have mentioned, because if you have to show gross movement on a credit card, it could be all the gross drawdowns and all the gross repayments, so you don't have a real meaningful, like you say, meaningful information about the net movement during the period. And I think for those products or for those instruments, it might not necessarily mean providing gross information about the movements in and the movements out, but rather the net movements. And I think that's why we need an objective for what this reconciliation on the gross asset values need to achieve, so that you get the meaningful information out of the roll forward without prescribing information that doesn't mean anything.
Gary?
Thank you. On paragraph 41, if we went with the alternative B, I have two questions, and they're sort of unrelated. When you say each measurement objective, in the ED. I'm not clear what you mean by, is it expected lifetime losses? Is it stage 1, 2, 3? Is it,
So
you know, what do you mean by that? And I have another question.
Right, so by measurement objective, we mean stages, either stage 1, 2, or 3.
Okay. So you would have a reconciliation of the care amounts for each stage? Is that how to read
that right.
sentence? So, but then when I think of a reconciliation, I sort of think of a beginning balance and a roll forward to an ending balance, or a subsidiary system rolling forward to a general ledger. But as I go through the second part of paragraph 41, would focus on the key drivers rather than all the changes. That's not really a reconciliation. Is that just snippets of information? And what do you do with the difference? Do you plug it all other? How would you do this?
Yeah.
I don't follow. I sort of buy into the, I understand the logic, but I don't follow how you actually would do it.
Under alternative B, everything that you, you know, any movements that you don't consider to be the key drivers for the change in the loss allowance will flow into it. And other lines, so that you still move from opening to closing balance.
Well, would you have to identify them, or is it just sort of needed to balance, or how would you?
Be a plug figure, Gary, for all the. It'd be a plug figure for all the ones that you didn't.
Mary.
Brianna, I just want to go back to what you said about the posting outreach. And the explanation of preparers about the problems in preparing the roll forwards. I think from what you said about the problem coming in from the snapshot for the collective assessment, that has no implications for alternative A, because alternative A focuses on a complete reconciliation only for stage 2 and 3, where presumably there's not the.
No, it would still, and it would mostly impact alternative A, because alternative A requires, you know, a detailed reconciliation, and the problem really comes in the assets that you move into stage two
on a collective basis.
So because A still requires that full reconciliation for stages 2 and 3, that same problem would still exist.
Okay, so basically the feedback that you've had is that alternative A poses, even though simplified for the ED, still poses significant operational challenges.
Yes.
Okay, that's a disappointment to me, because of the two, I looked at it and I thought A was more coherent to me in terms of focusing on the more problematic area and having a meaningful reconciliation, because I think if we say something like, you know, key drivers or simplified, it's not actually a reconciliation. It's something that almost could be done in a mix of qualitative and quantitative in terms of explaining what the key drivers are without faking it in a reconciliation format. So I did prefer A, but I can see the problems about asking somebody to do something that we're hearing is not feasible, given the discussion we had, I think, at the November-December meeting about the collective assessment, some of those challenges.
On the alternative B, that has some appeal to me, because it would seem that the main thing users want to understand from this gross occurring amount reconciliation is why has the impairment allowance changed. So linking it back to that would seem to be helpful in achieving that objective. I also think it might be helpful in helping people, for example, those who have got who are using the simplified approach for trade receivables, because they might not have to include in the reconciliation stuff that sort of come in and out during the period, and it might help partly with Philippe's point. I think that the thing we have to be a little bit careful about is, I think if I heard you correctly, you said we were planning to provide an example on the gross carrying amount. And so I'd be a bit concerned if people thought key drivers meant different things to different people, because then we'd lose comparability altogether. So maybe at a minimum we should say it, describe what we're trying to capture. So, you know, for example, information on the amount of new things coming in, so they're at least specific on a couple of specific things we definitely want included in there, and they understand that. One thing I'm still a little bit unsure about, though, and just want to make sure I understand is, On this issue about the fact that they may not know which specific assets are in stage one versus stage two because they're sort of doing a bit of an allocation depending on how they deal with the sort of macroeconomic factors, etc., on a collective basis. Don't they still need to have some sort of allocation of gross carrying amounts to stage two if they've put a lifetime allowance on some of the stuff even though it's not individually allocated? And are you thinking they'd deal with that by saying stage one, stage two, sort of specific, stage two, collective, that sort of split? Is that how they'd deal with it?
I think on the loss allowance side, so giving a roll forward on the loss allowance, that is how some of them are thinking of giving that roll forward, is splitting the loss allowance between stage two individually assessed, stage two collectively assessed. On the asset side, I think you can make an allocation of the assets at the end of the period for the, you know, the notional amount that you've transferred to two, but that would every time be, you know, taken out and something new put in. So you don't have a flow of information between that collectively assessed.
You know what number.
But you know the number at the end of the period that represents. And I think that could be, you could potentially deal with that by just having a narrative disclosure explaining that included in, you know, your gross carrying amount or assets to the value of X that represents assets being collectively assessed or something like that.
Pat?
Well, I appreciate all the work the staff has put into this. I think it's been excellent. And I think when I look at this paper, I believe what we have here is the most important aspect of the project. And the reason I say that is that I don't think we should be naive, nor should any investor be naive, that an expected loss model is going to be the panacea to understanding the asset quality of major financial institutions. And when we're giving them a toolkit to make estimates of future losses, the day they adopt this standard, they're not automatically going to be expert at that and do a fantastic job. So the way a reader of the financial statements is going to understand just exactly how effective and how faithfully they're applying the new principles is through this information. So I think it's absolutely important, critical, that we have a reconciliation. I think it's also very important that the other that Ian referred to not be the most material line item in the reconciliation. So to the point that Suzanne made, the reconciliation should include three or four key items. They must be critically, you know, they must be identified. So what am I thinking there? New financial assets originated, transfers between buckets, because they have to apply the measurement principle that way anyway. So if they're applying the principle, they have the information to provide that reconciliation. Modifications or renegotiated loans, and any write-offs. Those four areas are going to be critical to an investor's understanding of how management essentially is applying this model, because when they look at those amounts relative to the gross carrying amount, they can see essentially whether management's underwriting standards are tightening or loosening, whether or not in fact the experience of the bank or the insurance company, wherever we're talking about here, is getting better or worse over time. So developing ratios of these various components to their gross carrying amounts provides an awful lot of insight into what's going on. If you don't have the gross carrying amount, then it's just an absolute number, and you're not really given a whole lot of additional information to make sense of that. As I've looked at financial statements of companies in this area, I think this is probably one of the greatest areas where we can reduce the quote-unquote excess baggage of disclosure. I've been underwhelmed by the quality of information in the financial statements of large, I'll call them former major money center banks. They go on for pages, three, four, five pages without a single number, just talking about accounting policy. It's all worthless, completely worthless. They'll talk about their policy for forbearance and renegotiation, their policies for write-offs, their policies for identifying loans. It's all worthless without numbers behind it. So the more tables we can provide analysts who are actually following this stuff and looking at trends, the better off we'll be. And we can eliminate pages from the financial statements of these major banks. They're looking for a way to cut out excess baggage. That's the way to do it. Get rid of your accounting policies, because they make no sense, and they're worthless to me without numbers. If you're going to put numbers in there, terrific.
Okay, so then you cannot get rid of them.
it's a matter of how they want to apply it.
I suspect it will be end-to-end.
And did you want to include purchases as well? Pat, you gave four, but you left that.
Yeah, I would include originations with purchases. But to your point, you know, on some of these asset classes where you have, you know, not just millions, but billions of coming in and billions going out, a net addition, in my mind, makes complete sense for a credit card portfolio.
Stephen?
Well, I agree with approach B. I agree with what Sue said. I think it's important that we specify clear objectives to provide information. The key problem, as I understand it, and I attended one of these meetings, is the collective assessment at stage two. That because that will be done beginning of the year, it'll be done the end of the year, there won't be any identified transfers related to that collective assessment. So to specify we want the gross transfers for everything, I just don't think will work, and we'll just get a fudge somehow to achieve it. So if it was the case that everything was identified individually, stage one, two, and three, then everything could theoretically be tracked and everything would work. Now you still have the question of the systems not talking to each other and the cost of actually doing it, and we then have to assess cost benefit. But because we've got the collective assessment, I actually don't think it's possible to do the sort of gross reconciliations that were asked for in the ED. So I think we have to do something that is less than a full reconciliation, at least for part of it. We could ask for a full reconciliation for stage three, stage two individual, and the rest. That would be possible. Or we could, as I think that the preferable approach is, to ask for information about movements in the gross assets, which enables a user to understand the changes in the allowance, be very clear about the objective, provide illustrations, examples to try and get to a robust set of disclosures in this area, but I do believe that it's too much to ask for the full reconciliation for everything.
I'm out
because
of
money? Because they don't want to spend the money?
No.
Why?
Well, because of what I just said, because of the stage two collective allowance. I just don't think it works.
And also because we've made it more clear in the re-deliberations about the collective assessment, so we've actually changed the boundaries a little bit relative to what people commented on in the exposure draft, which is why it's helpful they have come to us with the outreach in response to the paper to explain that.
Yeah, could I just ask Steve a question? You were just saying that you thought it might be possible to do what stage three, because that's all individual, and then split stage two into individual and collective, so that stage two individual would be rolled forward and stage two collective would be kind of this key driver's point. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, I quite like us in the allowance part of it, and we're not specifically discussing it, to emphasize that providing information about changes in the allowance assessed collectively and individually is useful information. Now, I don't know whether we asked for four reconciliations instead of three and actually split that stage two allowance reconciliation, or we just ask them to identify what component of the stage two allowance has been done collectively. But I think that would be important information, and one of the illustrations that we were shown, somebody actually done that, and rather than as a separate column, as actually separate line items identifying the movement. And I thought that was very useful. But it's a question of then tying up that roll forward of the allowance with the roll forward of the gross. And I think we have to be mindful of the impact of the collective assessment in that roll forward of gross.
Amaru.
Much has been said already about the importance of reconciliation. I think Pat has pointed out how important it is for users. It's actually key to understand, of course, the allowance. As for alternative A, I understand the issue of cost and operationality. Although if particularly banks, have enough lead time to reconcile their risk management system with their accounting system, considering the date of issuance of the standard and the effective date, they would do it. It's a matter of course cost. And then calling for costs and benefits. And particularly I was persuaded by the staff's report on the feedback received after the paper was posted. And in this feedback, the comments made by users about the usefulness of the information. And I think alternative B strikes the right balance between cost, usefulness, and relevance. And I like Sue, I was, and I think we discussed a little bit in the small group meeting with the staff before about the concept of the key drivers that we are inserting here. But I do understand, and I think Stephen mentioned, I do understand doing in the ballot draft, the staff intends to explore the what we meant by key risk drivers, and also provide some examples I think would be extremely useful for outsiders to understand what we meant by this. So on balance, I think alternative B strikes the right proposal.
Would you have a minimum number of reconciling items?
Well, I have a personal experience with reconciliation. I think most of the issues that you mentioned, in some jurisdictions, they are provided in the reconciliation. I don't know if this would be the ones that in at an international level we are going to require, but those are good examples of important pieces to understand the allowance.
Thank you.
I do understand what Pat Finnegan said. I think it is very important disclosure for the financial institution. My concern is whether it is really important for the trade receivables. And we are providing some experience for the trade receivables that you can use only lifetime expected loss. Then if we follow the logic of alternative A, then we eventually requires full reconciliation for the trade receivable, which was pointed out by Sue. And actually, it is very inconsistent with what we have said and what we are going to say. So therefore, I don't think alternative A works. So alternative B is better. But before we talk about whether it's alternative A or alternative B, we have to seriously discuss whether this reconciliation of gross amount for the trade receivable is really necessary. As we discussed before, we know that in the case of trade receivable, normally its duration is less than 1 year. So then beginning of balance and ending balance, between the beginning and ending, trade countries, companies has lots of new trade receivable and lots of trade receivable already collected. So how come do we have to ask such a movement of a gross amount for the trade receivable? So that is the point we have to address. And we are not very clear with this issue in our exposure draft. And that's why a lot of comment came in. But if we made it clear that this requirement is really necessary for financial institution, but not for trade receivable, then that would alleviate for us to go forward.
Martin.
Yeah, I was first in favor of alternative A because I think that was more consistent with our overall model, really concentrating on assets which have significantly deteriorated and then have more disclosure for that assets than for assets which have not significantly deteriorated in credit risk. But I was convinced maybe that people cannot do it in detail regarding this portfolio assessment, and therefore now I'm in favor with alternative B. But I have two questions then. Do we require then an alignment of the loss reconciliation to then the carrying amount reconciliation for the key drivers, because I think we should require, because otherwise to build ratios would not make a lot of sense, and it has to be aligned, I think. But my understanding was you still would require this detailed reconciliation for the loss allowance, but then key drivers for the carrying amount. But I think we should then in the text we should have some that should be make sense that okay, this drivers are aligned. Second is I agree with Pat that okay, maybe that is very important disclosure, but isn't it a disclosure if we have important disclosure if we have that for a kind of bank which mixes then all kind of financial assets in one reconciliation, like a retail portfolio and a corporate portfolio and a bond portfolio? I don't think it would make any sense.
Agreed.
So I think what we need is maybe some, if we allow key drivers, that also it make this disclosure has to be done by the major kind of classes of portfolios.
But
or do we have that already?
That's already in the exposure draft, because these disclosures would be included in IFRS 7.
Okay.
They are required to do these reconciliations on the asset losses they have in IFRS 7.
Apples to apples.
Yeah.
Okay, so I sense a broad support for the staff proposal and also a lot of sympathy for alternative B with regards to reconciliation.
Just one point, Hans. What's the staff response to Tuck's point on trade receivables?
I think after two alternatives, alternative B gives the better answer for trade receivables as well, similar to what it does for something like credit cards. I think it is still important to understand how the loss allowance for trade receivables have changed from one period to the next, and in order to understand that, you need to understand how the assets have changed. But I think that can all be done. So the key drivers for the change in your trade receivables could be a lot simpler explained than it could be for other assets, but I think alternative B would get you to a similar answer.
Can I confirm? So in that case, do you allow not disclosing gross origination and gross collection?
Yes, I think that is our intention, is not to necessarily.
Right, yeah. So are you going to make clear it in our draft?
We can look at it in drafting.
Right, okay.
How we
maybe we could have an example that comments on the disclosures might be suitable for somebody with
that's
trade receivables.
It doesn't get me through everything.
Just to visualize what this would look like in the footnotes. If you've got, say, five classes of assets on the balance sheet that are subject to this, times three stages, you'd have effectively 15 tables, and if you had comparatives, you'd have 30 tables with it. Is that the right way to think about this? Because you're thinking, if you have mortgages, if you have trade receivables, you have bonds and amortized costs, these would all be categories that have, in theory, will have some losses. So you're thinking, again, assuming five classes, three stages, and two sets of comparatives, you have 30 individual roll forwards.
That's right.
I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. I'm just confirming that that's what the expected published product would look like.
Gary, I think it's worth saying some banks already do a very similar type of disclosure.
No.
And the way you effectively do it is just columns in there.
I have a column for each
product.
No, okay. I'm not disagreeing with it. I'm just testing that's what it would look like. And maybe it's 30 columns as opposed to 30 tables. But yeah.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
I suppose so. We agree with staff recommendations and go for alternative B.
Yep.
Thank you. So we reconvene. I'm sorry.
All right. So moving on to collateral.
Maybe we can just explain that following the feedback we had post the posting of the paper, we thought it might be easier to take the board discussion in the order of sort of the importance of the disclosures or the feedback we've received. So we sort of change the order. So we'll first talk about collateral, and then we'll look at the other disclosures.
So which paragraph?
49.
49.
The staff received feedback for the collateral disclosures that disclosing the gross carrying amount of assets that have zero expected credit losses because of collateral would require individual tracking. Now, we note that this requirement was intended to provide information about asset classes that are fully collateralized, and we recommend to clarify this in drafting. We also received feedback that providing quantitative information about the effect of collateral on the loss allowance, as seen in 40C of the exposure draft, was felt to be operationally challenging and would require entities to compute the expected credit losses twice. We therefore recommend to address this by removing the explicit requirement to disclose quantitative information, and then to compensate by expanding the disclosure to all assets rather than only those at stage three.
Similar to the feedback we had on the roll forwards, we've also had some feedback on the collateral disclosures, both from preparers and from the users. And I think from the preparers' side, what has caused the biggest concern is the fact that we require the financial impact or the extent to which expected losses have been reduced through the value of collateral, and that implied that they need to look at each loan individually and assess what is the value of the collateral assigned to the loan and to what extent what would the losses been if the collateral was not there. In our discussions, I think we did clarify that the intention with that was similar to what is in IFRS 7 today, where they provide an estimate of the value of the collateral, and that would enable you to assess the extent to which losses have been reduced if you know what the value of the collateral is. The feedback we've had from the users were that they agree with having qualitative information about collateral for all assets. They find that very useful. But for the assets in stage three, they regard quantitative information about the value of the collateral as absolutely essential. They think for stage two, the value of the collateral is highly recommended, but it is not as essential. And then for stage one, quantitative information would be nice to have, but it is it's not as essential as it is for stage three. So following from that feedback, that would basically take us back to what is in the exposure draft requiring quantitative information for assets in stage three.
But would that then, with the clarification that what you mean by that is the extent to which the collateral has affected the calculation of the ECL, not a revaluation of the collateral?
Martin?
I think it is. It is just, we meant the same thing as what we require in IFRS 7 today, but the wording we've used is different, so that implied we are requiring something different. So maybe we can move closer to the wording that is in IFRS 7, but just limit it to stage 3 assets instead of all the assets.
Martin?
I really think we now to say, okay, we should have qualitative information about collateral for all stages, I think is, at least what I think, really meaningless. Because if you want to have some conclusions and what Pat said, for example, what we discussed earlier, if you want to calculate coverage ratios and you don't have really quantitative information about the collateral, mine it is meaningless. And I think really we should then focus on this stage three assets and should provide quantitative information, because otherwise we have some wording, okay, bulk of our assets are collateralized, but what does it mean, I think. Therefore, I think we should go back to what we have in the exposure draft, focusing on stage three assets and then provide quantitative, because qualitative, I don't see any.
Philippe?
Even for stage two, to the extent that the amount of collateral is an element of the calculation of the expected credit loss,
yeah,
and the loss given default, why not disclose that? But for stage one, where you have no expected credit loss, any information about collateral seems to be pretty useless.
On the stage two, I think some of the concern with giving the collateral information for the assets in stage two as well is it goes back to the collective assessment of the assets. So if you don't
But in doing this collective assessment, you have two elements. You have the expectation of a credit loss and then the calculation of a loss given default, which could be a statistical. But in doing that, you have to take into account a certain estimate of how much collateral you have, even if you don't do it on a loan-by-loan basis. Otherwise, you overestimate your loss given default if you don't regard the impact of collateralization. I don't know how people can do a calculation of an expected credit loss in stage two on a collective basis without having some information about the collaterals. How do they do it? Or do they just ignore it? Or if not, that information needs to be disclosed. And the calculation of that estimate needs to be explained. Just do it in a qualitative manner, saying, oh yes, I've taken into account my collateralization. Yes, but so how do you do it?
Ian?
Yeah, quite the same, but I was worried about the last couple of sentences of paragraph 56, where all of a sudden we've made it qualitative for all financial assets. And did the users ask for that, or have we just thought it's a good idea at the time, or how did we get to that position?
Rihanna?
Are you referring to qualitative information for everything?
Yes.
It is already, IFRS 7 already require that, and I think even paragraph 40A in the exposure draft required qualitative information about collateral. So
we're not changing anything?
We're not changing paragraph 40A, but the proposal in the paper was to make 40C and the extent or the impact of collateral on all assets was to make it similar to, I think, bring it closer to what is an IFRS 7 without a specific requirement that it has to be quantitative.
Tricia?
It's similar to Philippe's point. It's important, and I don't see where we require it necessarily. Maybe I'm just not making the linkage. It's important to understand what the quantitative information represents. Is it a current fair value? Was it the fair value at the date the loan was issued? Is it made? How often do they reassess the value of the collateral that they're using? You need to know something about where that number came from. Did they just pull it out of the air? Or is there some substance behind it?
But yeah. Paragraph 40A addresses a little bit of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Darryl?
I would be very supportive of what Martin said at the outset on stage three. I think there is no question in my mind that the number that you have taken into account of collateral in determining the loss should be part of your calculations. It should be a number that's available, and it is a critical piece of information in understanding that. I would make the clarification that I mentioned earlier, although I think the wording is clear enough. But I do think that at least some people were concerned that this would require them to go out and revalue the collateral. And I don't think that's what we were saying, but I think we just need to make sure that that's clearly understood. I started out with a position very similar to Philippe in thinking about stage two, in thinking that in the stage two calculation, you are also making some type of assumption about collateral value. I think the concern with stage two is, though, we are envisaging assets in stage two where the actual default event might be 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line. And it may be that banks in that circumstance are using expected loss numbers rather than breaking it down into the different components, because 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line, they don't have a clear view of what the collateral component would be. So I'm a little bit more sympathetic on not disclosing it there, but I think I would be inclined still to encourage a disclosure of the number you've taken into account, unless you haven't, and then you need to explain why you haven't taken a collateral number into account.
Yes, please, go
on. Quickly, I agree, Darryl, completely on that one. I think with stage two, Philippe, what happens is one, excuse me, completely agree. You have to have some idea of how you're computing your LGD, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do it. The two things that happen is, as Darryl put out, these are longer stage assets, so we are making estimates, so we do not recompute the fair values. That's not done. You make an estimate whether you have enough coverage and your loan to value ratio comes in. for just to look at a mortgage loan. What happens is that to pull this number out, you'll have to run the models twice, as we have spoken in the paper, because one without and with to show what is the effect, one way of considering it. It becomes a lot more onerous for people to do this with stage two because it's bigger, so we need to consider as a board whether it's really going to add the value to the information you're looking at. And secondly, the complexity comes in because it's not individually assessed, it's a portfolio. So I will use a curve.
My point is just to say, if the loss given default is estimated at 20% on average, mm-hmm. is that gross or after collateral? First question.
Okay.
If it is after, if it is maybe 30% minus 10% effect of collateral, I need to know it. I need to know I have taken out 10% because of collaterals. And I have to explain a little bit why I estimate 10% of collaterals reducing my loss. If I don't say anything, if I say I've taken a 20% estimate of loss, how useful is it to the user to know that? I mean, I'm not saying that you must disclose it in a very detailed manner, but at least explain how you calculated the loss given default and how does the effect of collateral come from? Is it pure guess or is it some form of rational calculation? I mean, Pat, you should agree with this.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Just to clarify, Philippe, you're not asking for detailed quantitative information. What you're proposing is some kind of indicators of how that is impacting.
How the entity came to concluding that it can use 10% effect of collaterals to reduce the loss.
That's a good question. That I would imagine, but this is just speculation on my part, that when an institution is estimating its loss given default, it would be looking at past experience with loans of similar types,
yes.
in terms of what the experience is, and that experience presumably is either, you know, they would be able to say, we believe that the loss given default 20% is our starting point, and that reflects any collateral that we typically get for these arrangements. So it's just saying whether or not that historical experience is anchored in with collateral or without.
I'd echo that. I think it's already probably implicitly covered in some of the objectives of describing the methods and assumptions you've used in estimating expected credit losses. So we probably just need to bring it out as an example of thing we're interested in. Because I don't think we want to end up with pages and pages of LGD assumptions and how it's all worked, but a description of how collateral has been factored into the calculations and how it's affecting allowance balance is what really
that,
what we're looking for.
If that
for.
Is the objective, absolutely.
I call it quantitative, in a way, it's too qualitative.
Not too boilerplate challenge.
I want to see some assumption, I want to see some explanation, some
work. Not completely boilerplate.
Am I looking at that we have considered collateral in our LGD computation, something more than that? Okay, fair.
Just reinforce the importance of this point. I think Philippe made a very good argument. And I, of course, in terms of operational costs, requiring the entities to go to millions of collaterals and revalue all of them, all different types of collaterals. But I cannot see how come, we are talking particularly financial institutions, can calculate expected credit losses without consideration of collateral. So this information is really key, and I think the staff has captured the essence of our ideas about the type of information that might be useful in explaining the level two.
My observations are very much aligned with Philippe's. I think if we're going to distinguish portfolios by those that are evaluated collectively and those that are evaluated individually because they're significant exposures, we should apply the same principle here. So to the extent that you have a large exposure, let's say you're a bank and you are involved in the syndication of the acquisition related to Verizon's acquisition of Vodafone, right? And let's say, you know, there was $60 billion in that acquisition attributed to debt. Let's say you've got $1 billion exposure. That's something that I think should essentially, along with all the other individual large exposures, have, if it's in category two, an assumption, a stated assumption, and Kumar, numbers behind it, not just a qualitative discussion, numbers to essentially assert what your expected recovery is so that people can make judgments. Because if another bank has exposure to Verizon or another insurance company, they can, you know, draw their own judgments. on a collective basis, I completely get where you're going in terms of, you know, the overall assumption. As Mary said, our experience is we typically have a 15 or 20%, you know, a range, frankly, it's not a number. It's a range of loss given default when these things, you know, go into bankruptcy or wherever they go. But I think individually large exposures, it's very critical for both stage two and stage three.
Could you then, in the paragraphs where we require the, you know, the sort of the qualitative description of collateral and the quality of the collateral and the types of collateral and all of that, would you then want to say something that you need to provide the quantitative information about collateral for stage three, as we asked for in the exposure draft, or for other assets where the collateral is meaningful and the information would...
I think for stage two, obviously, I think that would be appropriate. Stage three, we're saying quantitative information. Stage three, I think... For individual exposures, it's critical to an understanding as to what the ultimate outcome could possibly be.
Create a disincentive to do individual assessments.
But so you could get away from it, though.
You're getting very close to disclosing almost
anything. You're going to assess an exposure, a billion-dollar exposure, with all your other credit cards? No. Just not happening.
Only thing back to some, one of the things I agree with you, let's say your Verizon example is a classic case where you're looking at. We need to be slightly cognizant. What just worried me a little bit is how far we are getting in where people will start saying that, okay, with these kind of exposures, if I'm giving what my expectations and everything, we're almost coming too near to proprietary information regarding how I manage these
people. In some jurisdictions, you can't give that information because
exactly.
It's confidential.
That's
you're not going to identify the individual loan per se.
But
it's the balance.
I think where Pat's probably getting to is saying that you give qualitative information unless there has been a specific quantification of, and then you would say this is the category of specific quantification and that's the amount of collateral that was taken into account in those. But is that meaningful?
If you
don't actually know the underlying...
But if you're part of a group of banks that typically get involved in leveraged loans, right, large corporate leveraged loans, and you've got a balance of $10 billion of them on your books, okay, and you've got a $500 billion portfolio. And $10 billion is significant to your capital. It's significant to your earnings. And if all those leveraged loans went, you know, within a year or two, that would be real meaningful. So disclosures about not only what stage they're in, but the assumptions you're making about those leveraged loans in terms of your LGD and the rationale for it is very critical.
The problem is I almost come to it from the other side and say that if I'm looking at a homogeneous book like mortgages,
right,
then knowing that my value of collateral has gone from 65% to 75% is meaningful because I can assess that in the context of the home loan market and
right,
say is that reasonable. If I'm looking at individual leverage loans making up a portfolio and I don't know which leverage loans are in there, I don't know whether the number tells me anything, whether it tells me whether I'm making a good assessment or a bad assessment, because I haven't got...
From the investor's perspective?
From the investor's perspective. I haven't got the key information which is telling me it's this type of loan or that type of loan.
I'm relying on management, though, to give me a faithful representation. I agree with you. I'm not going to get all the details. I'm relying on management to give me a faithful representation that I've looked at all these corporate loans, these leveraged loans, and I've decided that on this one, I've got a 5% LGD. The other one, I've got a 45%.
If you're relying on management to give you a faithful representation and the individual amount of collateral is not necessarily relevant, then surely the overall LGD is fine. The actual,
yeah, agreed,
the actual ECL.
Absolutely.
But you've got the actual ECL. That's not a separate disclosure. The expected credit loss. You know what that is on that portfolio.
Yeah, if it's in level two or level three, yeah.
I'm with Daryl. Might it make sense, maybe if you have this number for an individual loan, maybe then you can make your own judgment. But you have it as a portfolio of individual loans, you cannot make any judgment of that. You can only, if you have a homogeneous portfolio and then you have the average number of collateral, then you can make conclusion. But to ask for, if it is the collateral for an individual loan, is material, then to have some disclosure, but you don't want to disclose which kind of loan or what loan it is, I think it is not.
I agree
really
with you,
meaningful.
But let's say you had a $10 billion exposure to, let's say, 25 various issuers. And the conclusion is that your net exposure is $2 billion. You're under-collateralized. Do you think that's relevant information?
No, I think the information what you want to charge is a loan loss provision which you have done. Is it sufficient? So and you cannot make it for individual
well, you might have
loans
more than
which are not homogeneous to have some number.
You're naked.
You cannot make a conclusion.
Okay. What you're saying is you're under-collateralized by $2 billion. Okay. Do you think that's relevant to the judgment about the number they're putting up as the loan loss allowance?
The thing is, I think you are trying to assess whether or not the ECL that is being provided against a particular portfolio of loans is appropriate. Now, to my mind, you can do that by assessing where home house prices are priced. Because
let's
you're looking at a homogeneous.
Large leverage loans.
But if I'm looking at large leverage loans, I don't actually know what's in that portfolio.
Yeah.
So how can I tell
whether individual components
are appropriate?
Description. Okay. The loans in this portfolio represent loans made in association with mergers and acquisitions to large corporate entities. And in fact, they might even identify, you know, it's a 50 billion, it's 100 billion, it's made up of 1,000 credits, it might be made up of 100 credits. Okay, and we believe that we're, you know, 100% collateralized, 9% collateralized, 80% collateralized.
I think the concern for me is you're aggregating non-homogeneous things and then
trying to draw
a homogeneous conclusion from them, and
which is not.
I don't see how the information is useful.
Okay. The board has asked for certain clarifications.
I think the way I would ask the question is whether you agree with retaining the requirement as it was in the exposure draft, subject to clarification of the extent to which about the information that we are requiring, so it's closer to
stage.
We don't ask for a revaluation or a specific valuation of the collateral, but rather just the extent to which that value has been taken.
Stage three.
Yes, for stage three.
And something more general about the nature of the calculations for stage two.
Yes. So, subject to those.
Two clarifications.
Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that one down to the vote.
Okay, last bit.
We'll discuss the remaining disclosures as a whole and then open it to you for your discussion. For modified financial assets, disclosure requirement, paragraph 38 in the ED, we received feedback that the disclosure of the gross carrying amount of assets modified for which the measurement objective has changed from lifetime to 12-month expected credit losses required tracking of individual assets until derecognition and was inconsistent with internal management practices where such modified assets are tracked while they are being managed by a recovery unit, but that go into the normal pool of assets when they return to the business unit and they lose that modification flag. We're therefore recommending to limit this modification disclosure to assets which have transferred back to 12-month expected credit losses during the period. Now, we also received feedback on the disclosure about write-offs, that disclosure of the nominal amount of assets written off that are still subject to enforcement would be operationally burdensome and result in misleading information. We're therefore recommending to disclose the nominal amount of such assets to those written off during the reporting period, while providing narrative information about all other assets written off that are still subject to enforcement activity. Finally, on the credit risk rating grade disclosure in exposure draft paragraph 44, we received feedback that the requirement should align more to internal credit risk management, and this included such situations as when assets are managed on a delinquency basis or when an entity has less than 3 internal credit risk rating grades. We're therefore recommending to align this requirement with internal credit risk management by firstly allowing the use of an aging analysis when an entity uses delinquency practices, and then also not mandating the minimum requirement for 3 grades in the disaggregation. We had a number of other changes to disclosure requirements within the paper, but we'll allow you to bring those up if you find it relevant to discuss.
Martin. I really think when financial asset has to be already written off, man, that is really when management has judged, okay, there is not any worse. And to now have really burdensome disclosure requiring really provide information what could really recovered, I think, is a little bit overdone, right? And therefore, I really think we should not ask for quantitative disclosure, because it is, many banks don't track it, because it is not numbers-wise. It is okay maybe for enforcement, for litigation purposes, they have to do that, but really not really in the accounting system. And therefore, I don't see the usefulness of this kind of information, really, if it is with a lot of cost.
And that's the feedback we received in the post-paper discussions with preparers.
It would be the same if we asked for if property, plant and equipment is already written off, depreciated, and maybe still in use, what is maybe the amount for that in usage? Right? It is the same, right? And we don't do that, right?
Why is this so incredibly funny?
I actually thought IAS 16 had a requirement to disclose assets that you are still using after you've completely.
Oh, you see, that's why it's
scrap.
Amaru.
I'll just reinforce, I do agree very much with Martin on this. I think if something is important, is how much was recovered from written off, past written off assets, but not really keeping this information as suggested here.
I would think the recoveries would be part of your roll forward or your loss allowance, so you probably would see that. You know, and if there were big recoveries sustained over time, would question.
This was one of the issues mentioned by Pat when he described his ideas about drivers. I do remember that.
And perhaps as some background to this write-off disclosure, originally we defined write-off as assets that you have no reasonable expectation of recovery and that you've ceased any further enforcement activities. So we deleted the second half of that definition because of user concerns. Well, we want to be able to see those assets that are still subject to enforcement. But as Martin said, we got a lot of feedback that if you have no reasonable expectation of recovery, there's a bit of a contradiction there. And so the disclosure originally in the ED was designed to give users some forward-looking information, because while the staff recognize that you won't be able to quantify the amount you expect to get back, that'll only arise through the reconciliation and recoveries, there was the idea that the disclosure of this nominal amount could provide some expectation of what might be a
I don't know how you would define enforcement. I mean, you write off a mortgage, there's a lien on the property, and you sort of wait till it sells. Is that enforcement, or is that just protecting your rights? I just don't know how you do those things.
I think enforcement means where you are still trying to recover.
Well, in theory, you're probably always alert to recovery. You know, I mean, I would say you're having a lien on the property, you're trying to recover. You will recover when that property sells.
Call it recovery activity. Is this an ingrained term? And the enforcers, it sounds rather ominous.
The problem with Gary's example is I don't know that if that would have qualified to write off in the first place. That shouldn't be a write off because you've got an assumption of these are loans that you've actually decided to write off.
Yeah.
But you might just get a payday at the end.
You might get lucky, you know, presumably always might have surveillance, I mean, whatever, you know, but I just don't know how you define enforcement versus active enforcement versus you got lucky.
Okay. Mary?
My question is about the redefault discussion. Do you want that now?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like I'm probably missing something on the mechanics, so apologies. But if we are going to require, and yeah, I get the point about cleaning up the drafting, but if we are going to require disclosure of items that have been moved back to stage one, and then subsequently deteriorate again. And I think this was discussed in the context, if I'm remembering correctly, loans that have been modified, moved back and forth. I don't see how you can do that without specifically tracking individual items. And I'm asking that not because I'm inexorably opposed to doing that, but I want to see if my understanding is correct, because that does seem to be very different than our approach with all the other disclosures.
Yes. The pre-deterioration rate, or the re-default rate as it is, as it was labeled in the exposure draft, is similar to the re-aging rate that some, or that most of the banks have on some of their products. So products where they do have, like credit cards and mortgages, where they do keep the information about what has been modified, it's cured again, and then it went delinquent again after that. Mm-hmm. So it is similar to that rate, and I don't think the intention is to require a re-deterioration rate on every single modification you've ever done, but it is where that information is meaningful and where consistent with the way they are providing it today. I think it does provide useful information.
I absolutely can see that it would provide useful information, but how are they doing it today without individual tracking, or are they actually doing individual tracking to satisfy that disclosure requirement?
I think it depends from entity to entity. So I think there are some banks that would flag a customer, so once modified, always modified kind of thing. You always carry that flag with you, whereas other banks don't do that, and they don't necessarily have a re-aging rate for their modifications.
So I'm not sure where that leaves us in terms of the disclosure proposals that you discuss in paragraph 48.
I think one of the overall aims of the disclosures, or with relooking at the disclosures, is to make the objectives clearer about what you need to disclose, and you only need to provide, you should only provide meaningful information or information with meaning. And I think this deterioration rate will tie into that objective of giving deterioration rate where it is meaningful information and it is being used today. So
I can see that it's meaningful, because I think there's been a lot of focus on, in the wake of the crisis, whether financial institutions are engaging in forbearance in order to keep down some of their loss rates. So I can understand why it's seen as quite meaningful information. Do we know that institutions, so it seems important, seems that we should require it. Do we know that institutions can do it? Have we bottomed that out?
Given that they said that they would be problem to keep providing the disclosures sort of indefinitely on things once they've been modified, I did have the same question in terms of, don't they need to do a similar tracking to provide the redefault?
I was more comfortable with this one, and I thought that the concern around tracking the portfolio on an ongoing basis is when something goes back into the good book, if you like, you don't worry about it at that stage. But as soon as something deteriorates again, you look to the history of that thing that's deteriorated to understand what happened.
But you would have had to tag it then to know.
And maybe this is a question we need to ask, but certainly in my personal experience, those get flagged, because you want to know whether, you want to have some sort of assessment of whether your forbearance approach has been successful in the past. You also look to whether or not, when you look to whether you would again allow a restructuring or a modification, you want to know whether this is the first time you're doing it, or it's the second time you're doing it, or the third or the fourth.
And believe me, I absolutely...
It seems to me that I would have thought at an individual level you are flagging that sort of thing.
And are you flagging it in a financial reporting system as opposed to a credit system? Because
well,
that seems to be the other...
That might be more of the issue.
And maybe what we are saying here is this is a place where you have to go and extract information from your credit management
system. Because the information is as critical as it is. And I think the fact that we've got the symmetry in going up and down...
Yeah.
I think means that it does make this information really important.
Don't take anything I said as being against this disclosure. Yeah. It just calls into question some of the assertions of we don't do it, we don't track, we can't do it in other analyses.
We did have limited outreach on this, but we can always ask the question again and bring it back as a sweep issue if we think there's a problem with it.
Yeah. Okay.
I have one additional thing. There's a recommendation on paragraph 83, because we want to change the disclosure objective and saying it should be how an entity manages credit risk. I really don't think that doing that, because managing credit risk is something different. It is okay, do they use credit derivatives, do they have limits, whatever. We don't do all that in this disclosure. It is to make, maybe to make credit risk more transparent, and, but really not to manage. I think I have some problems with that word as an objective.
Okay.
Can we then just ask whether you agree with the recommendations we've made on the remaining disclosures?
Agreed.
That's the case.
Yeah. Right, so okay. Now I just want to add my 5 seconds.
Sure.
Now that you have agreed, as I predicted.
Now that it's too late. Learn from a master.
This then concludes our re-deliberations on the impairment proposals on the expected credit loss ED. We will, at the February meeting, we plan to bring papers on the effective date of IFRS 9 as a whole. And we plan to ask for permission to draft. And if there are any sweep issues, as we discussed today, we may bring that to the February meeting as well. We will also at that meeting provide an update on the FASB's decisions and what their next steps are in terms of taking their model forward and finalizing all of that. But this is then the end.
Is there any possible discussion about if assumption we do not align the calculation of the expected credit loss with what kind of bridge would there be between the two views? I don't want to use a different word than bridge because it's vague enough, but I mean, if we fail, or if they fail, if there is failure on aligning the calculation of the determination of expected credit losses, what do we say? Okay, that's it, too bad, or what else can be done?
I think the two models are so different that trying to bridge that through disclosures effectively means asking people to do the two models.
It might be, we may conclude if it's possible, but I think we need to have at least that discussion and conclude that it's not possible to do anything on that basis, but I think we need to assess.
What is also important to know that most probably the FSB is going to, that we're going to have a meeting with representatives from the FSB later on this year, once the two models are completely clear, and that then regulators might also look at what they would ask their constituents, the banks, to give in additional disclosures as to how the two models relate to each other. Do I say that correctly, Sue?
Yeah. I personally.
But I would not like to have a repeat of what we did with derivatives, which basically means that the banks have to do two models and present two models. It's a lot of work, obviously, the ideal situation would have been that we were completely converged on this, but we cannot let, I think, the preparers pay the price for the two boards not getting completely converged.
Okay.
Thank you.